Brethren, have you ever been inspired by someone's faith? Ever been inspired by someone's faith? I'd like to tell you a quick story about rock climbing. Rock climbing, summer 1980. It's a long time ago. I was serving as a counselor at SEP in Orr, Minnesota at the time. And I had a camper in my dorm that was very afraid of heights. And yet we had a rock climbing. It wasn't really a rock climbing class in this case. It was a rappelling class. Rock climbing is where you go up the rock. Rappelling is basically where you come down, either the rock or the air. You can rappel through thin air as well. Bottom line is that in this case, we were able to set up a rock wall that was about 30 feet high. It doesn't sound like a lot, but when you're three stories off the ground, held by just a rope, it can be pretty intimidating. And it was for this little 14-year-old that was a part of our dorm. The idea was you began up on top and you got placed in a harness around your bottom, basically. And there's a clip there, long story how you hook yourself in. But there's a clip there and then the rope wraps around your back. And you hold it in the small of your back. And then as you let that rope go, it releases and you can start walking, in this case, down the slope. Now, it was a pretty steep rock wall, pretty much a straight drop. And it was an opportunity to help kids learn to overcome some of their fears and also give them an opportunity to do something they normally don't get a chance to do. Most of us don't have rappelling at our home. So it's an opportunity to give them something to do. Well, this little guy began the process, talking the whole way. I don't think I can do this. I'm too afraid. I'm not sure I can do this. And we'd try to encourage him. I know you can do this. You can do it. God will help you. You know, have courage. Have strength. It'll be okay. You can do it. Took a great deal of talking to get him started. He's got his harness on. We call it his diaper. He's got his diaper on. He's got his hand back there. He's got the rope in both hands. And his eyes are as big as dinner plates. But we got him started. Go ahead. I'm standing directly in front of him, looking in the eye. Go ahead. Take that first step. Once the first step is the hardest. And it's kind of... So he started down and got down about 3 feet, a little too far to come back up. But you're past the point of no return now. And he absolutely froze and just stood there, kind of shaking, looking straight ahead as if the world had disappeared. Come on, you can do it. And here we are trying to encourage him. There were two ropes that went down, and obviously the other kids on this side are going and going and going, and he's frozen on the side of the rock, trying to encourage him. Look up, look at me. Jimmy, look at me. Okay, you can do this. Take another step. You can do it. Frozen solid. So I got my diaper on, got on the rock next to him. Come on, Jimmy, here's how we do it. One step at a time. Just take a little step. You can do it. God's not going to let you fall. Now there's a safety rope tied to this child as well that runs up above the rock so that if he just loses it, lets go, and starts to flail through the air, the belayer on the bottom tightens the rope and he's caught, and it can lower him down. But the idea was, no, we're not going to lower this kid. You can do it. He can do it. I know he can do it. So there we are standing on the rock after about 35 minutes of standing on the side of the rock, frozen, talking to him. God's not going to let you fall. You can do this. You can trust him. He finally looked at me directly in the eye and he said, if God wanted me dead, I wouldn't be here. I know I can trust him. And he started walking down the wall. And it was just so inspiring to see that faith finally sink in. That, yeah, I wouldn't be here if God wanted me dead. I know I can trust him. And so he relaxed his grip. He walked down the wall, came back again, and did it fine after that. Once he conquered that fear, his words have stayed with me all these years. I know I can trust him. Now that was a statement of faith. And I asked the question, how is your faith doing? Is it doing well? Is it strong? Is it secure? Is it a bit sick or anemic? Today, during the course of the sermon, we'll take a look at amazing faith as displayed by Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. You know these three men well. In so doing, as we study their story, we hope that your faith is strengthened and that you know, like that 14-year-old on the rock wall, I know I can trust him. Turn, if you would, with me to the background of Daniel chapter 1. The background of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. You know them better as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel chapter 1 in verse 1 begins to tell the story about these three young men of amazing faith. They were not probably much older than this 14-year-old we just described about at this time. Some say 15 or 16 possibly. They were very young men at this point. We would call them teenagers in all likelihood. In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, came Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, unto Jerusalem and besieged it. So, here's your country being attacked by an enemy, being taken over. Verse 2, the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand, with part of the vessels of the house of God, which he carried in the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and he brought the vessels unto the treasure house of his God. The very God of the universe, the things that were used in his temple, are now residing in a pagan temple. And in verse 3, the king spoke to Aspenaz, the master of the eunuchs, that he should bring certain of the children of Israel, and of the king's seed, and of the princes. So during this siege, a lot of stuff was taken back to Babylon, and a certain group of individuals. The children of the leadership of Israel. The brain trust, we might say. The movers and shakers of society. Their children were taken away. Verse 4. Children, in whom was no blemish, but well favored, and skillful in all wisdom, and cunning in knowledge and understanding science, as such as had the ability in them to stand in the king's palace, in whom they might teach the learning and tongue of the Chaldeans. Now, young people, if you're in school, here's another reason to do well. Because if you're ever taken captive, there'll be a test. If you pass the test, you might go into captivity and serve in the king's court. If you don't pass the test, you'll either be killed or left behind to starve to death. So a pretty good option in this case. So these were young men who had wisdom, who had understanding, who studied hard, who knew what they were doing. And they were seen to have great potential. They were going to be taught the Chaldean language, integrated into society. There would be a number of reasons for this. When your kingdom is made up of people of all kinds of groups, it's stronger as a result. And when you're inculcated into the system and help support it, you're less likely to rebel against it. So it was wise in this way. The king appointed them daily provision of the king's meat. And of the wine which he drank, so nourished them 3 years. At the end thereof, they might stand before the king. So they would be in an intensive 3-year training program. Verse 6. Now among these were the children of Judah. Who was it? Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So these four friends were in this together. A 3-year intensive training program. Unto whom the prince of the eunuchs gave names. He gave unto Daniel the name of Belteshazzar. Daniel means God is my judge. Belteshazzar means I'm a prince of Bel, one of the pagan gods. Or watch over him, Bel. So instead of Daniel, now it's Belteshazzar. To Hananiah, the son of, and to Hananiah gave the name Shadrach. Hananiah means the eternal was gracious. Shadrach means inspiration of the sun god. So the Babylonians, even what they called these people, tried to inoculate or inculcate into them the Babylonian way of thinking. Mishael means what God is. Who is what God is? He was given the name Meshach, which means who is comparable to Venus. Talk about a change in name. Azariah means the eternal helped. His name was changed to Abednego. Abednego means servant of Nebu. Nebu was the fire god. Nebu was the root of Nebuchadnezzar's name, Nebuchadnezzar. Three sections to his name. One was the god Nebu. So we have four young men in this case. We'll focus on three of them that become, in essence, slaves of the system. They're going to be indoctrinated in the Babylonian system and used in the government. You remember the food controversy that takes place next. Daniel proposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's food, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the prince of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. Now God had brought Daniel into favor and tender love with the prince of the eunuchs. Isn't that an interesting thing? That as a 16-year-old, he stood out to the head honcho. Maybe his kindness, his thoughtfulness, his respect, whatever it might have been, he stood out. And of course, as a result, they were allowed to have their dietary changed. Now, maybe these four teenagers, asked not to eat the king's food because it was unclean. It might have been ceremonially unclean, or it might have been physically unclean. It might have been a daily portion of roast pork or starfish or whatever the Babylonians eat. Well, they didn't want to eat it. They said, just give us vegetables. And the boss said, I don't think I can do that because if you end up sick and looking bad, I'm going to lose my head. So Daniel said, well, trust us. Feed us vegetables for 10 days. Feed us that big salad made by Queen of the Eunuchs, Donna Moore. You know, that beautiful big salad. Feed us that every day and see how we look after 10 days. And if we look better, great. If we don't, we'll start eating the king's food. Well, after 10 days, you know the story. They look better. They look great. So verse 16, Meltzar, who was the prince of the eunuchs, took away the portion of their meat and the wine that they should drink and gave them vegetables. Verse 17, as for these four children, Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, as for these four children, God gave them knowledge and skill in all learning and wisdom. And in addition, Daniel had understanding in all visions and dreams. So God blessed them incredibly. We don't hear of these young men again for a little while. Let's read in verse 18. At the end of the days, the 3 years, that the king said he should bring them in, then the prince of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar. The king commanded or communed with them, and among them was found none like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. So not only was there a quiz at captivity, now 3 years later, they're quizzed by the king himself. He wants to listen to how they speak the language. He wants to see what they understand about the system, about how government works there, and all manner of knowledge and understanding, and they pass the quiz. Nobody was like these four. Verse 20, in all matters of wisdom and understanding, they may be 18 or 19 by now, maybe 20. In all matters of wisdom and understanding that the king inquired of them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers that were in his realm. Fascinating. They studied hard. They learned well. And as a result, God blessed them. And as we said, we don't hear about them for quite some time now. The end of chapter 2 in verse 48. This is after Daniel interprets the dream that Nebuchadnezzar has and is brought to prominence as a result. Verse 48, then the king made Daniel a great man and gave him many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon. So now Daniel becomes governor over the headquarters area and chief of the governors over all the wise of Babylon. So now that Daniel is in charge, what does he do? He grabs his three friends, who likewise were just as smart, just as sharp, just as helpful. Verse 49, Daniel requested of the king, and he set Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon. But Daniel sat in the gate of the king. So the three young men did not have regular intercourse with the king. They didn't deal with him on a daily basis. Daniel did. But they took care of all the affairs. Daniel had to have someone he knew he could trust. that he knew was competent. This wasn't just nepotism. He got the three most competent individuals he knew to run the issues of Babylon. Now, we must remember, was no one running Babylon before? Now, somebody was in charge of this province before. Now, if you are told, I don't no longer need your services, we're going to put this Jew in there, what might you think toward this Jew? Well, you might not like that. So in this action, although it was beneficial for the province, because you have the right men in the right job at the right time, there would be enemies that would be jealous. There would be enemies who felt they had been pushed aside. Enemies that felt they should have been given this role. And those enemies will seethe under the surface with anger toward these three individuals. Now, because Daniel was working closely with the king, it says, sat in the gate of the king, was in and out with the king in all kinds of business. He was kind of untouchable. But these three lieutenant governors were somebody that were targets at this point. And you can understand why. It may be, as we begin here in chapter 3, as many as 19 years later, after the event described in chapter 2, this interpreting of the dream. At least all records seem to indicate that that would be the case. So these men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, had been serving in these capacities for quite a long time, as much as almost 20 years. Why would Jews all of a sudden become the target once again of a problem, of a persecution? Well, it seems that at this point in time is the time that Nebuchadnezzar sent his last army to Jerusalem. Jerusalem had rebelled again. They'd put up their own king. They'd sent to Egypt for help. Nebuchadnezzar had enough. So it was the final destruction of Jerusalem. It's when the temple was completely destroyed. All the people left were taken captive except for a few of the very poorest who lived in the region. So it's at that time, after that event takes place, at this time, that now those who were enemies of the Jews felt they had an opportunity. Now, it's not unusual. We've seen another story a little bit later on in Daniel about how people orchestrated a major event to isolate and kill one person. The people wanted Daniel. So what did they do? They made this declaration. You can only pray to the false gods. You can't pray to the real God. What did Daniel do? He prayed anyway. Similar situation here. Verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold. Was this his idea? Was it somebody else's idea? We're not told. My guess is someone else presented it. He accepted it, thought it was a great idea. Because that's what happens later on in chapter 6 when we get the lion's den issue. The king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. It's an immense statue. Some think the platform was 40 feet and the statue was 60, but it's kind of hard to tell exactly which was which. The point is, we're talking a 10-story building. I mean, this is before the modern forging that allowed us to build skyscrapers that can go 100 stories or 200 stories. Amazing to think of those things. So this was an immense statue for its time. Would have been very impressive, probably covered in gold. Some feel it might have been a copy of what Nebuchadnezzar had seen in his dream when Daniel told him, "You are the head of gold." Remember with that statue. It might have been an image of Nebu, for whom Nebuchadnezzar was named. Nebuchadnezzar means Nebo is the protector against misfortune. Or may Nebo protect this crown, Nebuchadnezzar. Nonetheless, it may have been a statue of Nebuchadnezzar himself. Some feel that that's probably the case. Since Daniel told him, "You are the head of gold," the statue may have been the typical god or representation of Nabu, but the head was a likeness of Nebuchadnezzar himself. It looked like him. That's very possible. He was filled with pride and arrogance, so it very likely could have been a picture of himself on top of the god. You might jot down chapter 4 and verse 30. The king spoke, saying, "Is not this great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty?" He was vain. He was proud. And this statue certainly could have been one of him. Verse 2. Here in chapter 3, King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come up to the dedication of the image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now, one thing we'll note as we go past this verse is that these terms of leaders and the delineations are all Persian terms, not Babylonian terms. So some, then, throw a stone at Daniel and say, "See, Daniel was a forgery made up hundreds of years later by people who wanted to tell fancy stories that simply weren't true." Was that the case? Why weren't Babylonian terms used? Why were Persian terms used? Well, it's very likely that when Daniel sat down to write the book, it was during the Persian era, not during the Babylonian era. No, most times people don't write down what happens as it happens. They sit down later on and they write from their recollections. I'll give you an example. My mother, about 10 years ago, decided it would be a good idea to write down the events of her life. So that's what she did. She wrote down many of the events of her life, and we've got a copy of it. We've enjoyed reading it over the years. Did she write it as it happened? She has no notes of what happened during the 80 years of her life. But now she has recollections that she'd like to share with the kids and the grandkids and the great-grandkids. So she's written those things down. Daniel probably was likewise. It would have been during the Persian era that he finally sat down to write these things. He was much too busy administering the kingdom at this point of his life, and probably during the time of Darius and others. So probably toward the end of his life, he writes these things down. So to relate to his audience who were there in the Persian era, he would have used Persian terms for these leadership positions. So we might say, if we're writing about the president to a British group of people, could we use the term the American prime minister? Would that kind of convey the same office? Probably, pretty much. So it's very easy to explain some of these things when we understand the Word of God is true. It cannot be broken. This is not just a fancy story. He simply used Persian terms because his readers would better relate to those things. So he used the Persian name for these offices, not the Babylonian names. So verse 3, the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered together for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Now, it's interesting that all these leadership positions, it doesn't say the typical man on the street. And it doesn't go above a certain level either. It doesn't include Daniel's position on here. Now, it may be that Daniel was traveling elsewhere when this happened, and therefore wasn't subject to this. Maybe he was carrying out the king's business elsewhere. Or it simply was that he wasn't required because of his level of closeness to the king. So, either way, it's clear that this was primarily targeted to the Jews. So whoever put this in Nebuchadnezzar's mind, whether it was his assistants, people around him, whether it was Satan himself, who would be the focus of this issue? Well, the Jews would be the only focus. Because all the others certainly did not have any problem bowing down before this statue. They could worship other gods and be their primary god. But for most pagans, it simply was no problem adding another god to the list that you already worship. Because their polytheistic mind had already been set that way. There was a god of the thunder. There was a god of lightning. There was a god of agriculture. There was a god of the water. There was a god of this and of that and the other thing. So adding one more, the god of fire, if this was Nebu, that's what Nebu is, he was the god of fire. Adding him to the list was not a problem. No problem bowing down before. Who had a problem with this? Those that believe the Lord our God is one God. Him alone shall you worship. What does the commandment say? He was a jealous God. God is the only God. You shall not bow down nor worship any of these other images, any of these other gods. So the only group that wouldn't be participating would be the Jews. Now again, someone set that up to get back, to get rid of these three, maybe all four, of these Jewish individuals that had taken such roles of prominence. Verse 4, then a herald cried aloud, to you it is commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, and psaltery, in symphony with all kinds of music, you should fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. Whoever does not fall down, verse 6, and worship, shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Pretty strict. Now again, if this was a statue of Nebu, the fire god, it would be a fitting punishment. You don't worship the fire god, you're destroyed by his fire. So a bit of irony in that sense. At the same time, if this was that picture of Nebuchadnezzar himself, he'd grown so vain that he wanted people worshiping his image, because that phrase happens much more than is logical. This image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. This image that King Nebuchadnezzar set up. We've already read about five times in the last three verses. So the indication is it probably was a statue of him. I'm always put in mind, since this was Babylon, the Iraqis, by the way, to this day, idolize Nebuchadnezzar. He was one of their descendants. Or they are some of his descendants. Who else had a large 30-foot statue in the square in Baghdad? You bet. So this is not unusual to have giant statues of yourself, apparently, if you're a Babylonian. Saddam Hussein had a very large statue. One of the images of the Gulf War is tank pulling this statue down in defeat. So it could very well have been a statue of Nebuchadnezzar himself. Nonetheless, you don't worship, you get thrown into the fire. Ironically, some feel it may have been the very smelting furnace that was used to create this image, that out of this fire comes Nebu, you refuse to worship him, you go into that same fire. So that was an interesting piece of information. It could be true. Verse 7, so at that time when all the people heard the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, symphony with all kinds of music, all the people, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the gold image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Therefore at that time certain Chaldeans, who were the Chaldeans? They were the ones who ruled Babylon before these Jewish people were put in place. So had this been smoldering for a couple decades, now's our chance to get back at these people, get rid of them? Probably so. Certain Chaldeans came forward and accused the Jews. That was the intent, really, of the whole event. Daniel, as we said, would face another event very much like that, a similar trouble. This particular event tested these men to see if they would do something that they shouldn't. The next test for Daniel was to see if he would stop doing something he should. And that was praying to God on his balcony toward Jerusalem, asking God's deliverance. So in both cases, sometimes we are tested to see if we will do something we should not do. Other tests are to see if we will stop doing what we should be doing. Two similar tests from a different perspective. So they spoke to King Nebuchadnezzar, verse 9, said, O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that everyone who hears the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the gold image. I've often wondered why these instruments are mentioned every time. Why don't they just say, when people hear the music, they're supposed to. They list all the instruments. Some say, well, these were the five most popular instruments in the kingdom, and then the symphony, this cacophony kind of accompanied that. So I don't have an answer for that, but it's interesting that every verse, okay, we know it's the harp, the lyre, the psaltery, and the... I always remember, you might remember the old King James language? It was the sackbut was one of the instruments. And I often wondered, what is a sackbut? I mean, what a strange name for an instrument. Okay, never mind, I won't go there. I assume you have to play the sack butt sitting down. That's just my guess. I don't know, because if you don't, it'll knock you over. Never mind. Anyway, goes on to say, you made this decree that they should worship the golden image. Verse 11, whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And there are certain Jews, verse 12, whom you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, by name Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not paid due regard to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the gold image which you have set up. So this would be an indication that the statue was of Nebuchadnezzar, not one of his gods. Because it says they do not serve your gods, or, in addition to that problem, they won't bow down to this statue which you have set up, the one of you, most likely. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So they brought these men before the king. Now you ask, why was Nebuchadnezzar so angry? Well, one reason could have been is because this was a statue of him, and he demanded they bow down and worship it. It was a personal insult to him, so he was very angry. Now, another possibility, certainly just as possible, is that here is the headquarters province, Babylon itself, and the three lieutenant governors who take care of everything, all the most important leaders, all three of them don't do this. What kind of effect does this have on everybody else? Well, that's going to cause real problems. So he was angry, whether it was just because he was personally insulted or because he saw this as a tremendous problem in the kingdom, one or both. He brought these men before him. Verse 14. Nebuchadnezzar spoke to them, saying, is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods, nor worship the gold image which I have set up? Is this true? Is it possible? On one hand, he's saying, did you make a mistake? Verse 15. Now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, flute, harp, lyre, psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. In other words, he's giving them another chance. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. He was going to carry out that punishment. But notice the last phrase of verse 15. And who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Talk about arrogance. I'm the guy who defeated your God and brought you here as captives. Who do you think you are? Who's the God that will deliver you? Now when you challenge God, you're in for trouble. Now God was very patient with Nebuchadnezzar. Gives him many chances. He didn't quite get the idea that God is the only God from the dream sequence. So he has another opportunity here. He'll get another opportunity a little bit later on to understand that God is the only God. So who is this God? He challenges the great God of the universe. Verse 16. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king. Now here's where we see some amazing faith. I know I can trust him, is in essence what they're saying. Just like that 14-year-old on the wall. I know I can trust him. O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. In essence, they're saying we don't have to delay in our answer at all. There's no hesitation here whatsoever. Now talk about men of faith. I'm afraid that if I was in that situation, hope I could say this. But I'd say, do you have any sunscreen by chance? I don't know that I could say that. Hope so. Verse 17, no hesitation. If that is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. God is easily able to do that. If that's what he chooses to do. And he will deliver us from your hand, O king. In other words, there's no hesitation. We must do what Acts chapter 5 said. What did Peter and John say to the leaders of the Sanhedrin? When they were commanded not to teach about Christ, they said, we have to obey God rather than men. And that's what these men were saying. We have no hesitation here. Obedience to God is absolute. Now, if God chooses to deliver us, He can easily do that. Verse 18, but if not, let it be known to you, O king. Talk about strength and faith. They make a proclamation in the eyes of death. Let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods. That is a strong statement. Some would say I was surprised they even made it to the fire. The kind of anger that Nebuchadnezzar has. We do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the golden image which you have set up. They were making a statement that our God is the only God. He is the one God. We may not make graven images and bow down before them. Worship God and God alone. So it's interesting to understand that their obedience was not going to be determined by God's choice of action. Many people in the world determine their obedience based on God's choice of action. If God blesses me, I'll be obedient. If I perceive God isn't blessing me the way I think I should or He should, then I won't be obedient. And you may have heard things like that. I've tithed all these years, and now I lose my job. God's not faithful. Wait a second. Tithing is not determined on whether or not we have a job. When we have increase, we tithe. We don't tithe because God has given us a job, and if God decides it's time for some unemployment, that we won't tithe anymore. Well, obviously, if we have no income, we can't tithe. But we're not saying, God, I paid all this tithe. You owe me a job. That's silly. Our obedience is not determined by God's choice of action. That's what these men were saying. I will obey God regardless of what His choice of action is. Either to spare my life or to allow it to be taken. That's a huge statement of faith. Our obedience is not determined by God's choice of action. Verse 19, then Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury. I mean, they told him what it was. We don't worship your gods. We're not going to bow down here. Our God can spare us if He chooses. If not, that's the way it'll be. We still will go to death obedient to God. That's a statement of faith. Nebuchadnezzar was full of fury, verse 19. The expression on his face changed toward Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. You can imagine the snarl here. He spoke and commanded that they heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. Now, whether or not that temperature could be acquired is unlikely. But he's making this statement. He is so mad, he's saying something stupid. Heat that furnace 7 times more than it... Well, you know, a furnace can only be heated so hot. And if this is a smelter, we're talking about a milk bottle kind of shaped contraption, a kiln with kind of that chimney on it. You've probably seen some of those from ancient times. And they were able to hook up tubes to this and bellows and pump air into it and make the fire so hot that it could melt ore and they could bring metal out of it. They melted gold in this case, silver, brass they could make. So they got huge high temperatures in order to be able to make these things. So they pump this in, and it starts getting hotter and hotter and hotter. Probably as hot as they've ever had the fire before. Maybe hotter. I mean, why, once you get it hot enough to melt metal out of ore, why make it any hotter? You know, the bricks themselves could have started to glow around this kiln. It probably was so hot at this point. So obviously it would cause instant death to anyone thrown in there. You get temperatures over 1,000 degrees and you throw a body on it and it sizzles immediately. I mean, it's instant death just from the intense heat, let alone the burning itself. Verse 20, he commanded certain mighty men of valor who were in his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. In other words, they didn't have the chance again. He was so mad, he wasn't going to let the orchestra play and see if they'd do it again. They already made the statement they weren't going to do it. So he had the big guys come in. Tie these people up. So you can picture it, the muscle men of the army. The guys they always show in the movies with no shirts on. Muscles rippling out of places most of us never knew there could be muscles. And they grab these guys. Nobody's going to fight these men. And they tie them up, hand and foot. Verse 21. Then these men were bound in their coats, their trousers, their turbans, and their other garments. In other words, they didn't change anything, all their fine garments. They were simply cast into the midst of the burning fiery furnace. And because, therefore, the king's command was urgent, and the furnace exceeding hot, the flame of fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. So you can picture this as they open the doors, because you have to have that closed to get the temperature that hot to pump in that air, to get it through the flue so the temperature keeps increasing. They didn't have electricity to increase fires the way we often do today. To get this kind of temperature, they pumped and they pumped and they pumped. And so here are the men, four men, maybe eight others holding them. And as they open the doors to throw the fellas in, the flames just shoot out and burn to death the muscle men on the spot. And they fall over dead or fall in with them. Now again, these kind of smelting furnaces had an area on the top that you'd slide the things in to melt and pull back out, and the coals were down underneath that. So when it talks about they fell in, this would have been kind of below the surface of the ground, very likely a little bit. So then the doors are flung open. Dead guys are either burning there and smoldering or falling in and burning. And Nebuchadnezzar looks up, verse 23. These three men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, fell down in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, and he rose in haste and spoke, saying to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men into the midst of the fire?" And they answered and said, "O king, it's true." "Look," he answered, verse 25, "I see four men loose, walking in the midst of the fire, and they're not hurt. And the form of the fourth is like the Son of God." Now, pretty bad translation when it comes to Son of God. Literally, it means the Son of the Gods. He didn't believe in a Messiah, the Son of God. What he was referring to is this fourth one is not human. The other three look human. This one does not. So whether he had wings, whether he had halo, whatever. Halos, by the way, are a paganism. They're not found in the Bible. Point is, what Nebuchadnezzar saw was something non-human. So was it one of those archangels that had hooves and a head with four faces on it? Was it one of the cherubs that rescued these men? We're not told. But nonetheless, they're in a 1,000-degree-plus furnace, and they're not being touched by it, because they're receiving special protection. Now, they could have just fallen in and walked out, but God specifically had Nebuchadnezzar see that there was somebody else in the fire with them. So his God, his chief God, Nebu, the God of fire, did not have power like that God that was walking around on the coals rescuing these three men. So it would have been a major blow to him. His God was not the most powerful God. He would learn something from this. Nebuchadnezzar went as near to the mouth of the burning firing furnace as he could and spoke, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came from the midst of the fire. Now talk about faith. Can you imagine walking around in the fire? It's just hard to imagine. I mean, there you are standing in the midst of all these flames and not being burned up. It must have been a surreal experience to them. And certainly as they tossed it, they were tossed in and stood up, then they knew. They knew that God had intervened to spare their lives, not to cause them to burn up. Tell them to come out. So they certainly did. Verse 27. The satraps, administrators, governors, kings, counselors gathered together, and they saw these men on whose bodies the fire had no power. The hair of their head was not singed, nor were their garments affected, and the smell of fire was not on them. These very fine garments that they had. And as you know, in Persian times, lots of very fine fabrics were woven and put together. And these would have been very flammable. So they come out of this fire, and they don't even smell like smoke. That's pretty amazing. Now, obviously, what did burn up? Whatever was holding them together. It said they were bound and then thrown into the fire. So what burned up immediately upon entering the fire? Everything that they were tied with. But it didn't burn them, didn't touch their skin. They came out, didn't even smell of smoke. Now, all of us know you spend a minute around a campfire, and that smoke blows on you, your clothes will smell of smoke for hours. Where my wife and I house sat and babysat for a few weeks at a friend's house years ago who burned wood. Every once in a while, what would happen? You know, the flue was clogged up or it wouldn't work, and you build a fire and there's smoke in the house. And what I remember about that house, have the wood stove that we stock once in the middle of the night, once in the morning, a couple times during the day, during the cold winters. The couch that sat near this wood burner always smelled like smoke. Always. No way you could get rid of it. You could put that thing outside for a week, bring it back in, and it would still smell of smoke. Fabric is sometimes infused with this. And that was so amazing about this event. They went into the fire, didn't even smell like smoke when they came out. Therefore, Nebuchadnezzar says in verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar spoke, saying, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who sent his angel and delivered his servants who trusted in him, and they have frustrated the king's word and yielded their bodies that they should not serve nor worship any god except their own." Talk about faith. They didn't just yield their stuff. Some people are so attached to their stuff that they don't feel they can be obedient to God's commands because some of their stuff might disappear. What are they saying here? They yielded their bodies to God. They were completely full of faith that God would protect them. And if He didn't, they were still being obedient to Him. Job made a similar statement. He said, "All the day, though God slay me, will I worship Him." He realized that was the thing to do regardless of God's action. We don't determine our obedience based on God's response. We determine our obedience based on our obligation to God. And His response is up to Him as for what is best for us. So this was an outstanding event that took place. A great statement of faith on these men's parts. Can we trust God with things that are nowhere near the import as our lives? Verse 29 says, "Therefore I make a decree that any people, nation, or language which speaks anything amiss against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be cut in pieces, and their houses shall be made an ash heap, because there is no other God who can deliver like this." Nebuchadnezzar is getting a little bit closer. Then, verse 30, the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. So, brethren, we ask ourselves, do we have that kind of faith? Can we have that kind of faith? If God can deliver Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from this event, can God care for our situation? Can God take care of us? And the answer is, of course, absolutely. So as we close, brethren, I hope we can learn a great deal of inspiration and strength from the story of these three men, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Hope we can learn a great deal from them. Be much more like that little camper on the side of the wall. Look God in the eye and say, "I know I can trust Him."